My name's Paul Bestall. This is Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, we're joined by Seth Breedlove from Small Town Monsters to discuss the imminent release of their new film, Momo. Unsurprisingly, being someone who loves cryptozoology and really bad B-movies, Momo is a perfect combination of a mystery monster case from the early 1970s, coupled with some deliciously funny B-movie homage scenes, stitching it all together. Momo is one of those cases that, similarly to the Dover Demon, the Flatwoods Monster, and even Spring Hill Jack, seem to happen over a relatively short span of time, with hardly any incidents outside of the main event and the initial flap. We also spoke to Lyle Blackburn all the way back on episode 2, if you fancy finding out more about the case and the Hamilton family. So before we dive in, don't forget to follow us on Facebook under Mysteries and Monsters. We're on Twitter and Instagram as Mystery Monsters, and you can also subscribe to us on Podbean and YouTube. And don't forget, you can support us on Patreon for just $1 a month. Now, let's join Seth Breedlove. But first, here's the latest trailer for Momo to get you in the mood.
It was in the afternoon, and Doris Harrison, who was 15, was watching her siblings, Terry and Wally, who were out in the backyard playing. They were 8 and 5, and they were playing with their dog. They were enjoying themselves until they smelled something strange, something really strong and pungent, and heard some rustling amongst the tree line. They screamed, and Doris looked out the bathroom window and saw a creature.
One thing that I recollect, this thing was supposedly large, and it was supposedly hairy.
So it was, in 1975, a film crew set out to make a movie about another famous hairy monster, Momo, Missouri's own monster. The film crew shot and edited the film, but for some unknown reason, never released it.
All right, men, we're about ready to do something that's never been done before. We're gonna go out and try to flush out this creature they call Momo.
With the imminent release of the new Small Town Monsters film, Momo, almost upon us, I am delighted to welcome back Seth Breedlove to Mysteries and Monsters. Seth, thank you for joining us today. How the devil are we?
I'm good. I was hoping you were going to do like a really prolonged intro, and by the time by the time you finish this chiming, this incessant chiming outside my window, it would be done, but it's still going. So, no, I'm good. I'm losing my mind, but very good. No, very good.
Well, I think, yes, because I know the last time we spoke, we touched on the delightful ambience of your office area in regards to the chime. So it's nice of it to join us this time as well. So
it's endless.
So then, Momo is generally released next week, I believe.
Yeah, September 20th, the same day that the Fearless Raiders of Area 51 will be Naruto running, or whatever you call it, toward the the armed guards. The movie will also be hitting Amazon and Vimeo On Demand and VidiSpace and DVD and all that good stuff.
Absolutely. So if you don't plan on being shot or detained in a military prison, I would suggest this is a far more beneficial way to spend your time, Seth, because it's a cracking film, and it's quite different in how you've done the previous films and documentaries, because there's more of a tongue-in-cheek slant to the whole production. So tell us a little bit about the difference of direction from Momo in comparison to your previous films.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that there's a complete difference in approach from any film. I can't get, you know, like, I grew up a film geek, and like, that's all I did as a kid, and that's why I connected with the director of photography and the sound recorders who I've been friends with since we were kids. Like, we loved movies growing up, and I love movies now, and I am not familiar with another movie that uses a storytelling device similar to this. You know, where I mean, specifically the device we're using to tell this movie is unique, and that in itself is a win as far as I'm concerned. I just don't, you know, like, there's only so many new ways to tell a story when you're doing two movies in a miniseries every year. So this is the fact that we found something that's not only new for us, but new for, it seems like new for film, at least in general, is really exciting. But it's the true. So let me think of the sum up. It's hard to sum this up. It is the true story behind the Missouri monster legend. And it's told in a fashion wherein you are seeing a narrative film said to have been made in the mid 1970s that was never released, that gets juxtaposed against sort of the actual retelling of events from townspeople from the town of Louisiana, Missouri. Of course, in 1972, the Harrison family that lived in Louisiana, Missouri, began seeing this. Two of the boys actually saw this monster come down off the hill behind their house that was possibly carrying a dead dog, and they their sister saw it as well. They told their dad. Their dad went and searched the backyard, couldn't find anything, but did smell a strong odor, and he called the police, and the police investigated, and from there it kind of blew up. Around Louisiana, other people began having sightings, and all of a sudden the Missouri monster was all the rage around Louisiana, Missouri. It was being seen by multiple people almost on a daily basis, and for a short period of time, Louisiana, Missouri was at the heart of what they called monster mania. And as all this was going on, there was also a series of UFO sightings that were taking place around the area, and yeah, so that's basically what our movie sort of retells is the Missouri monster story, but it, you know, it does it in a way that is also examining storytelling, particularly storytelling through film and how it can evolve and change, how a film can evolve and change the reality of what people believe actually happened. And and there's a few different, you know, story threads going on, and there's a lot of subtext in the movie. And it's honestly, man, I still think it's probably the most proud I've been of a finished product that we put out. It's like one of the few times where I'm I'm rewatching the movie, and obviously I see all the flaws because I watch it hundreds of times, but there's a lot going on here, and I don't even know. You said you've watched it twice. I don't even know if twice will reward a view. I mean, it is something where every single time you come back, you're going to get a little bit more information, and because it's hard. There's a lot going on here, and I think that's interesting to see, especially from some of the people that have written about the movie, is that some people are picking up on things that are going over other people's viewers' heads, and that's really interesting. I think it rewards paying attention to a degree that no SDM film before has done so before. But it is also, I think it's a movie for people who love movies. I said that today during conversation I was having with Mark and Zach, and actually this morning Mark and Zach and Jason and Adam were all over here. Which, by the way, Adam, sorry, he couldn't be here. He had a car emergency. but yeah, I said it's a movie for people who love movies, and I believe that as much as it's, you know, as much as we make movies for fans of the paranormal and cryptids, this is a movie for people that are into movies.
Yeah, I mean, for a B movie addict like myself. As soon as I saw the beginning, I just went, right, well, that's Carpenter. And then obviously you've got the quotes from Corman. There's bits of it there's a lot of nods in it. Well, I may be completely misinterpreting them, Seth, but to William Castle as well. Mm-hmm. There seems to be a lot of love, as you've referred to about your love of cinema and film. Mm-hmm. I think this has allowed you to not that I think you were shackled by the previous films, but I think because the way you've gone at this, you've been able to sort of release yourself and pay homage to some people you clearly respect greatly.
Oh yeah, the nature of it in general opened up doors for everyone, not just me as the director, but I know Mark who let's real quick, I'll talk about how the script came together, and that'll allow me to mention Mark here and what he did with it. This was unlike anything we've done before, in that there was a really intense pre-production process. SDM movies are there's no pre-production. It's me and I sit down and I come up with a list of names, and then we start, you know, going in and contacting people and trying to get witnesses. In this case, we had meetings. There were multiple meetings ahead of time, and I had help. And I've talked about the collaborative nature of the film too, but there I had help from multiple people. The first sort of like narrative film meeting was Jason and I, Jason Udis, who co-wrote the script, and I sat down together, and I knew the story points I wanted to hit, but we were not sure how they would all sort of flow together. So Jason and I, point by point, sort of put together a plot outline. And again, this isn't how you normally would do screenwriting or film scripting, but in this case, it's necessary given the fact that we're retelling actual events. So we knew the plot and how each story point was going to go into the next. And then we had a meeting with Mark Matsky, who came over to the office, and three of us sat down and went through everything. And then Mark went back home and took a whack at the first draft of the script. And at this point, all he was writing was the narrative portion. None of Lyle's stuff was in there. So Mark went back to have a whack at that. And while he was doing that, we had a big meeting at my house that was that involved myself, Adrian, Adam Dugan, Zach, and Jason. And that was the meeting. So that meeting was sort of to come up with the logistics of who would be handling what, who would be helping get costumes. And that ended up being Adrian, and set design and things like that. And a lot of that stuff was Adrian and putting on her producer hat. But during that meeting, we also talked about the script a lot and how everyone felt about everything. And during that meeting, Jason suggested the idea of Lyle playing almost a sort of like a cable access horror host sort of guy character. And that was he says that was the moment where when we all said, sure, let's do that, he was convinced he had just sunk the entire movie because we decided to just go for it. Mm-hmm. So that was the meeting where Lyle sort of took on a almost like a character. I mean, he's playing himself in a way, but yeah. it's a heightened version of himself. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's supposed to be taking a slight jab at some of the television shows that are out there as well, in the editing style and things like that. My favorite shot in all of Lyle's sequences is the one where he's walking down the railroad tracks in slow motion. And I superimposed his face over the railroad track. And I don't know if anyone is going to get the idea that we realize that is a ridiculous shot. Like, yeah. I put that in there intentionally, because I think it's very silly so we had these meetings and then the scripting began and Mark took his first pass at the script and then he handed that off to Jason and I. And Jason and I both adjusted and changed things. And then I went back through and wrote all of the monologues by Lyle. Mm. And then there was the filming began. But what I was sort of getting to was that Mark has put in a ton of Easter eggs for fans, specifically of Creature from Black Lake and Legend of Augie Creek. There are lines that are lifted directly from both of those films throughout the movie, including we saw the boogeyman, we saw him. That's a line from Creature from Black Lake, and there's all sorts of little nods to those B horror movies, Squatch Boytation movies from the 70s that we all love. And but it was like the movie was an opportunity to do things we haven't ever been able to do in our other movies. And that would include, you know, you said tongue in cheek, and I'm sure there are very most definitely tongue in cheek moments. Specifically, like, I think a lot of Lyle's scenes are take on that sort of air about them. But it was a tight wire act too, because like the narrative, you never wanted it to feel like parody. You know, like we wanted it to feel like a movie that would have been made in the 70s, not a movie that's being made in the present day that's sort of poking fun at those movies. It is supposed to feel like that movie. And we knew that simply given the nature of what we were working with in terms of budget and, you know, that we had all these very gung-ho, like excited people who wanted to act in the movie but had never had acting experience. We knew just by the nature of what we were doing, there would be elements of that 1970s era and fun that would sort of seep into the movie. So it really, from beginning to end, it was a balancing act, because you always want the documentary portions to be straightforward and serious and that we're showing respect to the town and to the Harrison family, obviously, first and foremost, and that it never pokes fun at the actual people who lived the events. And I think we pulled it off. Like, I think at the end of the day, I think it would be difficult to watch the movie and say it in any way portrays the Harrisons in a negative light or in a bad way. So that it really was, from a storytelling standpoint, it was a high wire act from beginning to end.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, as you refer to there about some of the more modern films, which are basically taking the mickey out of some of the classic B-movies we all know and love. And I think that's the problem. I'm not a massive fan of things like Sharknado, because I think they know exactly what they're doing. And for me, what makes B-movies brilliant is, with the greatest respect, everybody in it thinks they're making Ben-Hur. Do you know what I mean? Because I've seen some wonderfully awful films over the years, Seth. And I think the only two real modern films I can think of that have paid homage in that kind of way are probably Tremors and Eight-Legged Freaks, because I think they're both, in essence, B-movies that very are well aware of what they're doing without going too far to be, you know, as you referred to, taking the mickey. Whereas this has all the hallmarks of some wonderful films, you know, as we've touched on already, Boggy Creek is one, and Creature of Black Lake. But I mean, there's a clip at the beginning when Lyle's doing one of his intros, and one of my favorite, the first time I ever saw this film, it terrified me, was Snow Beast.
Yeah.
And there's a clip.
It's
of
terrible,
that.
But yeah.
I mean, it's awful, that film. You look at it now. I mean, the first time I saw that, I was absolutely terrified. Now I can't get through it without crying with laughter. But it was clearly done as though it was, you know, their version of Creature from the Black Lagoon or wherever.
Yeah, you have to take it seriously. And I think, because I think otherwise we're going to end up in that sort of, I'm trying to think. There have been a lot of like parodies of older movies, and I think that I just don't think that would have worked for what we were doing. And so to take it seriously and just let the nature of what we're doing itself sort of inform the lightheartedness of the whole thing was important to us. And also, you know, like some of the acting in the movie for the fact that, you know, I think most of the people in the movie, with a few exceptions like Elizabeth Saint and Janet, most of these people would not refer to themselves as actors. Mm. But I think it's crazy they were able to pull off some of these ridiculous lines and things we were having them do and say, and you know, it's I'm really proud of it, man. I really am. Like I don't typically come out of our movies feeling like I'm sentimental about what we've done, but I feel sentimental about MoMo, the Missouri Monster. I think it's just because the fact that it was so collaborative, like there were so many people involved in making it work, and you know, like my favorite moments in the movie are still during the posse sequence with Cliff and Bobo, and I know what we put those people through that night, and the fact that that scene works as well as it does is a testament to how great, you know, the attitudes of everyone out there are, because we stuck them in the middle of the woods in 40 degree weather in for the most part, like short sleeve t-shirts and flannel. No one really had a coat. And they had to act for about 6 hours. I mean, we started filming that night 7:30 and didn't wrap till about 1 a.m. that section of the movie. So it was a long evening.
Yeah, I mean, I gave a little cheer when Cliff and Bobo turned up. And I thought, because obviously I knew they were in the film and I knew what scene they were going to be, but when they turned up, I was like, yay! And Cliff seems to relish his position in the film. He's really good. He's obviously as the main sort of guy in the posse. He's mm-hmm. chewing the scenery at some points. It's brilliant.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You know, no. And they came prepared, man. Like they showed up with their lines memorized and they knew what they were doing. Like they were, the Bobo might genuinely be the biggest Small Town Monsters fan I've met. Mm-hmm. He's seen all the movies. He has his favorites. We did Michigan Paracon together a few weeks ago, and it was unfortunately a screening of Terror in the Skies ran at the same time as like two other events, yeah. And very, very few people showed up, but like last row, like sitting right there, the entire movie was Bobo. And then as soon as the Q&A started, even though it was late and like most of the crowd disbanded, Bobo sat there and asked me questions for like 20 minutes about Small Town Monsters. And, you know, he's genuinely there. They're both genuinely fans, but Bobo's all in on Small Town Monsters. But yeah, Cliff was into it, and Cliff can act. Like I would put him up against Laurence Olivier. I think he was eating his lines like they were pudding or something. But my biggest regret about the film is that the posse sequence isn't like an extra 5 minutes long, because I just really liked how it all played out on camera. Now, I would not have wanted to film another 5 minutes. The night we shot that scene was exhausting, but the way it plays on screen is really solid.
Yeah, it just makes me chuckle. I mean, Cliff could be the cryptozoological version of Solari, couldn't he? Yeah, I mean,
Yeah. So, yeah. Well, like the best line in the movie, the best two lines in the movie to me belong to those two guys. There's the there's Cliff's very serious stoic yelling into the woods that, you know, I forget how the line goes. Whatever the line is that ends his posse sequence where he points his gun toward the camera. And
says, this has got to stop.
Yeah, that line. And then there's my favorite line in the movie is Bobo walking up the hill, seeing the eyes and saying there's something on the hill, kill it. Which is like a pretty obvious nod to Finding Bigfoot, except for the kill it part of that, you know. And so there's that sequence is really, really fun to me. There's that's also, you know, like for the most part, the narrative portion of the movie plays out in pretty short bursts, you know, like three to 5 minutes. And those two sequences, actually, I think it's 5 minutes would be kind of long. I think it's like 3 or 4 minutes. But those two sequences, the scene that opens the movie with the picnic girls, and then the scene that sort of establishes the Harrison family. That sequence, that runs about 9 minutes, and then the posse sequence, which I think comes in at like 7 minutes, including like all the second posse's stuff with Edgar chasing Momo off into the woods and all that. Those are the three longest chunks of narrative film in the movie, and those are probably my three favorites in the whole thing. Although I love the way the crazy board scene plays out, where he's got his like board in the garage that he's trying to track where Momo is. I really like the way that scene plays out. However, there is a version of that scene that is so much cooler, but we couldn't do it because we couldn't get the rights to use the song we had under it. We actually had the original. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there is a song from the 1970s called Momo.
Oh, right. And
it was written by Louisiana locals. It was played on the radio and it was huge in Missouri. Mm. And the song's great. And we originally had that song playing under it. And then sort of halfway through the song, it takes on this warped quality and then just gets more and more warped until it deteriorates. And it's supposed to sort of like indicate Edgar sort of fraying, you know, as he's growing more and more concerned about his family and stuff. And it was really cool the way it played out, but we never could get the people that own the rights to get back with us. So we got it from the movie.
It is. I mean, that's like I said at the beginning, there are several portions of the film as a B movie lover that just made me chuckle. There's another one, which as soon as it starts playing, I thought, I know exactly what's going to happen here. And it did, and it just made me laugh. It was the bit where we hear Momo screaming into the night. And the shots of little animals.
Oh, yeah.
And that's always something that always reminds me, when you're screaming monsters in the woods, it's the animals that go.
Yeah, it's funny because I put that in the movie, and I think Brandon or Zach or Jason watched the rough cut, and they were like, I'm liking it. I don't understand the opening of the sequence where Edgar checks the backyard where there's like all of a sudden these three shots of animals. And I was like, well, I said, if you watch like The Legend of Bigfoot or Mysterious Monsters, those shots, that kind of shot happens. There's always shots of like animals running off. I was just watching one not too long ago. It might have been The Legend of Bigfoot, and it is, I'm not kidding, it feels like it's a 4 minute protracted scene of animals fleeing in terror from like Bigfoot in the woods. So that was what that is. That is 100% a nod to those like Bigfoot documentaries. And once the music was inserted into that scene and the sound design, it all made sense. Like everyone that watched it, then all of a sudden that became one of their, that scene actually where he checks the backyard is probably, it's one of my, in terms of like how it turned out versus how I thought it was going to turn out, that's probably one of my favorites as well.
Yeah. I mean, it reminds me of one of the worst films I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. Which is a Bigfoot film called Cry Freedom. Have you ever seen that?
I know the name. I can't. Is that packaged? I think on, Cry Freedom is packaged with In Search of Bigfoot on a DVD.
Oh, God.
I think it is.
It's on Netflix. It certainly is in the UK. It's on Netflix. It was part of the comeback of Mystery Science Theatre.
Yeah.
When they came back and they did it, and it's essentially an advert for a small town, which was financed by the mayor, who assumed that his son was going to be the next Disney kid. Unfortunately, his son can't act, and he just comes across as an obnoxious brat all the way through this film. But it's just awful, and they basically use a stock footage reel of animals scurrying off. About the same thing about 10 times in this film. It's horrendous. And it ends up that Bigfoot likes Coca-Cola and rock and roll.
Yeah, that's how ours is.
I would recommend, if you've got a free couple of hours on a weekend, Seth, get a couple of beers and watch it, because it's just dreadful. It's wonderful.
Sounds great. Yeah. Yeah. Those like 70s docs, I think, informed our direction of the movie more so even than some of the narrative B movies from the 70s, because I eat that stuff up, like 70s Bigfoot documentaries. I still in a lot of that stuff I genuinely consider good. Like I think a lot of it is actually really solid documentary fare. And I think some of that, especially the stuff that had recreations, like Mysterious Monsters comes up a lot. But there's like Man Beast and some of those other ones that are really Bigfoot Man or Beast, which is different from Man Beast, even though they have a confusingly similar name. There's how many Bigfoot documentaries from the 70s that are literally titled Bigfoot, and then there's like a subtitle or something like that. So, but the coolest thing about this movie is I don't think I had to do a ton of research in terms of the narrative portion. We knew, you know, I'm a fan of that stuff in general, and I watch a lot of it. So I kind of knew what we were going to do, you know, with the narrative movie to begin with. And we do a lot of like slow zooms and the zoom shots. I'm a big fan of that stuff. Adam hated it, because I was obsessed with like trying to zoom in on his face as close as I could get, and we'd stand right in front of during the Mrs. Sutter, the scene where Mrs. Sutter finds the three-toed track in her field. We shoot a really wonky sort of like shaky slow zoom in on Adam's eye. And it took me at least 20 takes to get that right, and he was losing it by the time we were done, because we're all standing out there in the rain, and I'm just like slowly zooming in on his face repeatedly. but yeah, I could have made another. We could go out and make another movie exactly like this, just because we had so much fun doing it, and it was a lot of fun. I don't think I would go make another movie like this, because that gets boring. But there's a lot here for us to sort of sneak in Easter eggs, you know, and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's definitely B movie muscle memory, I think, Seth.
Yeah, for sure.
we know the certain tropes that you can just throw in there, because there are so many films that have done them. But even the portions with Lyle, like, you know, as you referred to a while ago, you were on about the railroad track. Mm-hmm. The bit that strikes me, there's a couple actually, that is one where he's pointing to the river,
sure.
And he just seems to do it for ages, and it's like it's really poignant, and then he looks at the camera as though that just
I'm really glad you caught those, because you're the first person to say anything about that. and I feel like there's that, and there's also the fact that like two or three times I leave the edit go too long.
Yes.
Like I let the scene should be ending, and it lingers for like a half a second or a second too long, and it's like one of those awkward mistakes that like an amateur will make in an edit, and I did it on purpose, because to me it's funny, because it's kind of awkwardly originally the few times that I did it almost lasted two, it was like 2 seconds of him just sort of standing there awkwardly waiting for the camera to end. So I did that a couple times, but I'm glad you pointed out that point, because the point's hilarious. I love the point and the superimposed walk down the railroad tracks.
Yeah, the other ones when he's doing the clapperboard and he makes the old lady jump.
Oh yeah, yeah. that's movie magic though. That's me.
That's brilliant.
Because what happened is like The entire shoot was sort of wrecked with one disaster after another, most of it due to like rain and storm. And one of those was that Lyle was originally supposed to fly down to Quincy, Illinois, and we were supposed to pick him up on our drive from Ohio to Missouri in Quincy. But because of the storms that were taking place in Dallas, he could not fly out and missed an entire day of shooting. So he missed two of the interviews that he was supposed to be there for. So there's actually two interviews in the movie where it's not Lyle you're seeing in the scene. It's actually my shoulder. I did a sit-in, and it's me sitting in for old Lyle. But that actually happened twice, and that was one of the Martha Sue Smith. That's one of the that's one of the scenes that he couldn't be there for.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting as well, because I think out of everything you've done so far, I think Momo's probably the one with the least supporting evidence for it being a phenomena, if you know what I mean. Compared to, you know, some of the other films that you've made are very well-known cases now. Mm-hmm. And obviously, Terror in the Skies was a selection of a variety of flying creatures and cryptids.
Right.
Whereas Momo is essentially a very small scale story, but it obviously Lyle's book came out earlier this year, and I think it's one of those cryptid encounters like the Dover Demon that's very brief, but seems to have outlived its expected lifespan.
Well, there's a large number of sightings that took place around the area, but. You know, like the problem is, I think there's a muddying of the waters there, because there really were hoaxes taking place. So what happened to the Harrison family? I don't know personally. My opinion, having been there, having seen Marzoff Hill, I think it could have been something. If Bigfoot exists, I think it could have been a Bigfoot. I think it could have been, you know, I think it was something. I don't buy into them being hoaxed, the boys and Doris. I just don't – I don't see that being the fact. But the problem is, after you get past that event, that entire thing blows up, hits the local media, and then all of a sudden – you did have hoaxes, and you've got the I believe in the movie they talk about the two businessmen who had a suit that they would wear, but there were two kids who had a little suit as well, and that's pretty well known around town. And you have that, by the way, in most of the big sort of Bigfoot cases in Minerva. You had that. There was a guy that, you know, after the initial sightings hit the press, he got an ape suit and started running back and forth across Lincoln Highway at night and scaring motorists. Like, that did happen, but it happened because of an actual event that spurred him to do that. So in when it comes to the Missouri Monster case, I don't know. It's so convoluted because of the fact that you did have hoaxing. You even have the track that was faked. So it all becomes really confusing. But I personally, having been there, having seen the hill, and knowing the strange sort of history behind the hill, I could see the initial encounter by the children being something real. That hill is a very large wooded hill, and there aren't people on it, and it's sort of a, you know, perfect place to hide out if you're going to be up there. And there's a strange history of stuff taking place on that hill, including dog deaths, so, which we sort of hint at in the movie.
Yeah, there does seem to be some kind of weird secondary phenomena in regards to the dogs, because obviously, you know, Momo was — there was allegedly a spate of missing dogs at the time, and he was claimed that they thought he was carrying a dead animal that resembled a dog, and then dog deaths carried on. And then, like you say, you touch on the film about people saying that dogs seem to get poisoned or become seriously ill when they've been up there. That's one of those things I think sometimes gets lost in the story, because everybody concentrates on the main monster and sometimes misses all these secondary weird things that go on, you know, like we had in Point Pleasant. It wasn't — if you say to your average person Mothman, they think it's just the Mothman. And they don't seem to know anything about the Men in Black or the UFOs or the weird telephone calls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a lot going on around the area at the time, even beyond, you know, the funniest thing about them is so just to touch really quickly upon one of the narrative devices we're using. So in the narrative film, you see a lot of events and. There seems to be sort of a question as to what is real and what is not real. Now, personally, I think the documentary does a pretty good job of explaining what actually happened and what didn't. It might not get all the way down into the details, but if you watch very carefully, you'll be told what is pretty well regarded as fact and what isn't. There's a few things that are not related. That's not perfectly anyway. And one of those is that there were voices in the woods, and if you've read Lyle's book, you'll learn about that. The people heard disembodied voices telling them to get out of the woods. There was a disembodied voice that told someone it wanted coffee. It's a really weird series of events that were happening. There were orbs and smaller lights seen in the woods. There were UFO sightings taking place around the area at the time. So all of that information relayed in the narrative film is based on true events. It's not related perfectly, and certainly at times it's heightened to an insane degree, such as in the end. But you would actually be surprised at how much of that the narrative side of things is based on or are based on real events, especially when you get into the orbs and the lights in the woods and all that kind of weird stuff. So yeah, and you know, the cool there's something really interesting about meshing up that documentary with the narrative film when it comes to painting the Harrison family as real people. And I don't know if it hits as poignantly as I would have wanted it to, but there is something about getting to see Adam playing sort of a fictionalized version of Edgar that gives you a strange sort of like peek into the reality of how Edgar may have actually been responding. You know, where if he's just trying to keep his family safe, which I believe he was, and he really did send the family away. That's, you know, that's all based on fact. You know, like he's just trying to keep his family safe. When you get to the shot that happens at the end of the movie, and when you learn about the fate of the family, I mean, there is something poignant about that fact that goes back to some of the earlier SCM movies. You know, I think the movie ends on a pretty poignant note in general with Lyle's final monologue and all that stuff. And most of that's just because I'm a sap and I like to make sure that we always sap things up as much as we can. It's not all, you know, it's definitely done in the right spirit. It's definitely not, none of it's poking fun at the family or anything like that. It's as much a homage to the Harrison family as it is to B movies and Bigfoot film.
Yeah. I think it's another aspect that often gets overlooked when we talk about these incidents and experiences is the emotional impact this has on these people, because as far as they're concerned, they're absolutely convinced about what they've experienced, what they've witnessed, what they are going through. So not only do they have to deal with the fear of an unknown, you know, whatever this thing was, and not only in this case, in numerous other cases, they also have to deal with the ridicule and accusation from probably a large portion of their community.
Yeah, and I think in this case especially that comes across very clearly. Like as far as the documentary portion goes, I think this does a better job maybe than any other STM of sort of laying out the concept of what it is we do, and that is that you are very clearly getting you're very clearly getting sort of the rundown of how the town responded when this was announced or when it sort of hit the press, You're getting a rundown of how people reacted to the Harrison family, and you're getting a recap of where the town went with it after it happened and where it is at with it today. Mm-hmm. And it does seem like there was a very strong sort of it does seem a little different from something like Minerva, where the family itself was harassed pretty bad. It doesn't seem like it ever hit that level of things. But it does appear that the family was treated with a little more respect than they were in the Minerva case. But they definitely were teased about it, and a lot of people questioned, you know, whether or not they weren't just being hoaxed. And that seems to be the biggest. Even today, you go in there and people are like, I don't think that happened as they said it happened. I think they were hoaxed and they believed it. It's not their fault. They were hoaxed. And again, like, I don't necessarily know that that's where I stand on things, but I wasn't around at the time either. I'm kind of just going off the story as it was told to us.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Yeah, and I think that's probably, I think that actually speaks quite highly of the community, because they're not suggesting they're lying. Mm-hmm. They're suggesting that they were fooled.
And
therefore it's easy to understand why they reacted like they did. It's kind of like a sympathetic acceptance.
Sure. I genuinely believe that Edgar was a very well respected man in that town. I get that impression even today, and he's been dead for years. Mm. He was well respected. I think the family in general was. And it really is a small town. It's not as small as something like Falk, but it actually, like, in terms of size, it almost reminds you of like Point Pleasant, but it feels smaller. Yeah. I don't know if it's if it's a geographical thing or the terrain of the town, or, you know, the fact that it's kind of this little community that's pressed up against the river. Yeah. But everyone knows everyone, and they know everything about everyone. We would go into the gas station, and the person working the counter was somehow related to the Harrisons, and that was like really common. Like you would constantly, everyone knew we were in town to make a movie. They knew who we were without even us, you know, speaking to them, which is not that unusual in a small town, but it was surprising in a town that's as big as that small town. It's not a city by any stretch of the imagination, but it's not tiny like Falk, where you've only got like 700 people. Yeah. And the thing we heard the most was that they don't believe they were lying. You know, like they might have been fooled. I don't know if Bigfoot exists, but they weren't lying about what happened to them.
Mm. Which struck me as extremely unusual, to be fair, because most cases, you know, I've referred to Falk, Chestnut Ridge. These people are basically castigated for coming up with fantasies, but there often seems to be, like you say, that they seem, none of these families are ever sort of known as attention seekers or people who, I never buy into the, oh, well, they drank too much and they see things. Because, you know, I used to run a pub for 15 years, you know. I've never seen anybody drink that much. They hallucinated to that extent. So I found that a refreshing way of the town's accepting it, I felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to have been that way going back. Now, I do think, you know, I think there was some initial pushback against them by some people. And obviously I was unable to interview the children, so I don't know what their experience was at school, which would probably be the most telling thing. Yeah. But as far as the townspeople, okay, some of that might be because Edgar got to the point where he was a little aggressive about it. Yeah. You know, like people, I think even in the movie, someone says that he would fight you if you said it was a hoax.
Yeah. Yeah.
and that seems to be, you know, he took it very seriously because it was happening to his family. And I believe he felt like possibly there was a danger to his children. And by the way, their house is, I mean, it's kind of, it's almost on the hill. It's up at, you know, it's the incline would have been right out their back door. So that's a situation where if there is something there and you don't know what it is, you know, like, just change Momo into like a mountain lion, and then think of how a dad would feel if he had kids living in a house, you know, on a hill with a mountain lion, and people, you know, didn't believe him that it was there. And you can kind of put yourself in that position. I mean, I believe that he was genuinely concerned for the safety of his, you know, of his family.
Yeah, well, as any parent would be, really, in those kind of situations, because the terror that the children felt in that initial experience was, you know, and having read Lyle's book, it's palpable that they were terrified out of their wits.
It was sort of all of them too, by the way. I mean, the one thing I know our movie did not do a great job of explaining, and some of it is just the nature of the story, but there were more than just three children in the Harrison family. It was a large family. You know, for the sake of the movie we were making, it was very difficult to get into all of that without the Harrisons there to sort of speak for themselves. So I know, you know, in multiple, they had more than just Terry and Harrison, or Terry and Wally, and the other boys also had a sighting that was actually originally part of the narrative film. We had actually written a scene that was cut from the final film that was a recreation of a sighting that happened by two other Harrison boys. So there were other kids, and they all had their own experiences living in that house and heard strange sounds up on the hill, not necessarily like what you would associate with Bigfoot, but more of I mean, there were growls and things like that said to be coming off Mars Off Hill, but there were other sounds that were coming off Mars Off Hill that seemed more tech based, which is very interesting, loud humming and things like that. And the scene in the movie, the prayer meeting sequence, is sort of a nod to that, what the Harrisons said to be hearing up on Mars Off Hill at that time.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite an interesting aspect of it, because, you know, this family had lived in this area for quite a while. It would be easy to kind of brush it off if they had recently bought the property and weren't used to it, but they'd lived there long enough to know their environment.
People don't seem to move in Louisiana. When we were there, the Harrisons are still there. Yeah. I actually spoke to Doris. So I, you know, like they're there. They know the town. They know where they are. They're familiar with that hill. You know, and supposedly at one time the kids used to run up on that hill and they would play on the hill. So that's part of, you know, Edgar's hesitance about what was going on with the monster, I think, was because his children are running around on that hill. But yeah, they're familiar with the area, and that's why, as other sightings start happening around the area, you know, then you get some corroboration. And some of those sightings happen in places where a hoax probably doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, out on River Road and things like that, where you're outside of town, you're outside of the area where it would make a lot of sense for there to be hoaxing going on. You know, like the more rural areas where people see the monster sort of crossing the road or something like that. Where it starts to sort of defy logic for it to be two kids in a suit or two businessmen in a dragon suit at like 12 o'clock at night who are trying to promote their business. That doesn't make a ton of sense. It really is an interesting area too, just like in terms of terrain and the way it looks. I've never been to any other place quite like it. There's these very large hills all around Louisiana. Mars Off sort of sits with the town ringed around it, almost like a horseshoe. It's really interesting. It's like they built the town around Mars Off Hill. It's hard to miss Mars Off Hill, actually. Like, once you're there, you just look for the radio towers, and that's where it is. You know, like, it's not a place you're gonna miss.
I think the thing that strikes me about when you do some of the shots of the town is, I think what makes it seem smaller is that it's a very green town. There's trees all over the place. It's beautiful to look at.
Yeah, and once you get outside of the town itself, it is extremely rural. You're near Mark Twain National Forest. The area outside of town is not not typical Missouri or Illinois. It's very forested, very hilly. It almost feels like you're in honestly, it almost feels like you're in Southeast Ohio. You know, like the really backwoods or West Virginia. That's the kind of vibe you get on some of the back roads down there. And we were there when the flooding was happening, which created a whole nother, you know, series of obstacles as far as getting around is concerned. But it's a very rural, isolated place, Louisiana. It's not close to anything. You know, you're over an hour away from St. Louis to get to anywhere where you can get a meal after 10 o'clock. You have to drive about a half hour. So isolated.
I mean, it's one of the things Ivan Sanderson said when Bigfoot hit the headlines was that, you know, in some explanations, hoaxing is less credible than the possibility of something large walking about, because some of these, you know, I was fortunate enough to speak to Ron Moorhead the other week, who obviously mm-hmm. recorded the Sierra sounds. Mm-hmm. And that takes 2 days trekking to get there on horse. And some people said, oh, yeah, they've been hoaxed by people. And you were thinking, well, who on earth is going to ride into the middle of nowhere on the off chance somebody might turn up? And that's the, you know, with some of the witnesses in Momo, Seth, mm-hmm. there is that. Like you've said, it's a very small town. It's very rural. Not a lot happens outside those town boundaries at all. So for anybody to think, oh, well, I'm just going to stand here for 6 hours and hope somebody drives past, it stretches the bounds of credulity for me.
Yeah, and there are a number of Bigfoot reports from that part of the state. I mean, it's even today, they don't necessarily refer to it as Bigfoot. They say they had a Momo sighting. So the Missouri monsters sort of come to encompass all of Bigfoot in Missouri, it seems like. That's what they call Bigfoot, at least in that Louisiana area where we were. There's a statue in one of the local restaurants of a Bigfoot, and it's just a Bigfoot. It's like the one I have out front of my house, and they call it a Momo. And so that's sort of like, you know, Bigfoot to them is the Missouri monster and vice versa. And that's because there really is a long history in that area. I mean, the movie, as all SDM movies do, it sort of opens with Lyle talking about the history of strange activity in Missouri, and specifically, you know, like lights in the sky and ghosts. But he talks about Bigfoot, and he opens with a story that I was lucky enough to find about the creature they called the devil. Which doesn't necessarily seem to be a Bigfoot, as this was some sort of 7-foot-tall, 8-foot-tall creature with tusks. Mm. But one of the things that is strange about it is that it supposedly had hair that hung down to the ground. And just some of the similarities between that story and the Momo story, it's kind of strange. Mm. So yeah, there's a history in that entire state of Bigfoot sightings. And on the last day when I drove, I had to drive Lyle back to the airport on Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. And on the drive there, I mean, it took about an hour and 10 minutes, and it was all back roads. And most of the way was cornfield and forest. And that's about it. You know, like you went through a couple tiny, tiny little towns, but for the most part, you're just driving on, you know, isolated rural roads. No one's around.
Yeah. I mean, how many cars did you see?
27.
I mean that.
No, I'm just kidding. I didn't actually count. No, it was like 5 a.m. and there was very little traffic out. But I mean, it wasn't much. Yeah, it wasn't much at all.
Yeah, which, you know, it just compounds the point, I think, more than anything, mm-hmm. Seth, that it's a very remote location. It's not as populated as some of these areas. I mean, As you've referred to, I mean, looking back at it now, and obviously you've started showing it, and obviously seeing some of the buzz on social media, and you've had some wonderful feedback. Has it surprised you that, I mean, obviously I think I saw the other day you mentioned the creator of Swamp Thing couldn't speak highly enough of it, which must be a massive bit of feedback for you.
Yeah, Steve and I did. So Steve Bissett is like the co-creator of Swamp Thing, and he's a cryptid fanatic, and he did our poster for Champ actually. Mm. But him and I have spent a good deal of time. He's done a 70,000+ word interview with me that has yet to see the light of day, but it's out there. There's a 70,000 word interview between Steve and I, and in that time, like, I've come to learn that he is a cryptid cinephile. Like, he has a book called Cryptid Cinema, and it's all about Bigfoot and all that kind of stuff. And he of all the people you want to get the movie, he's top. So to see him sort of get the movie, to understand what it is we're doing, and you know, get all the ins and outs of it, was very rewarding. I mean, like, I guess the thing, Adrienne said this to me. She said, "Well, we thought people would either love it or hate it, and how it actually is playing out is people either love it or they're really confused. Like they can't." So and it's interesting, you know, like reading the reviews, the negative reviews. I mean, there are people who they can't wrap their minds around the fact that the documentary portion is real, because they don't quite understand that people actually think they can see Bigfoot, or that, you know, that Bigfoot is real. There's people that are confused as to why the narrative portion of the movie isn't just a direct retelling of the original events. You know, there's some confusion in that way. And for me, again, that's just one of the, you have to pay attention to this movie. It's going to reward. The clock has started chiming again.
Yes.
It'll reward, you know, watching. It'll reward your attention, because all the answers are there to me.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's edifying when you do anything, Seth, that when you get positive feedback from people whose work you respect, it means a hell of a lot.
Yeah, no, for us, it's it always has. And in this case too, it's the first time we're trying something new, like we are with this production. And so for us to find out that people are getting what we're going for, and that they are enjoying those narrative beats as much as they are the documentary portion of the movie, is really it's rewarding. I guess, you know, what's really interesting to me though is that, to me, the documentary portion of the film is super strong. I think some of those interviews are some of the best interviews we've ever done. I think Snooki Ward's interview is fantastic, and she got so emotional talking about her dad, and I love that section of the movie. And even without the original witnesses, which has sort of become our thing, it still is so strong in how the people we did manage to interview sort of relate how the town reacted to the event.
Mm-hmm. So I know we were talking before we came on air that it seems that right now Momo seems to signal a kind of wake-up call for other media outlets. So how's that been happening? Because I know you mentioned that you've suddenly started getting a lot of buzz from sort of the mainstream.
Yeah, I think I think every time we release a movie, we notice an influx of requests from production companies and distribution companies. But I think with Momo, it's been much stronger, and I'm not sure what that's owed to, because frankly, like the amount of press coverage we're getting with Momo isn't anywhere near what we got with On the Trail of Bigfoot. So I don't know why, but yeah, we've been in talks with a few different, you know, a television television development company and things like that. And I think it's got to be owed to the thing I'm hearing the most, that this is the first time this has come up. Typically, what we would hear when we were contacted by these companies is what can you offer us as small town monsters? What can you offer us? And this time around, it's more like we're being contacted by people who seem to genuinely enjoy what we're doing and want to be a part of it. And you have to be really cautious of of that because it's Hollywood and yes. those people want to take you for all you're worth if they can.
Yeah.
So we've had to learn to be cautious of that, but I haven't heard it to this level where so many people seem genuinely familiar. They're actually familiar with the work and can talk to you about it.
Mm. It might be just one of those things where there's been a bit of momentum for a while, but it's Momo that may have pulled a few more people in to think because it is it's a strange thing to say. It would have been extremely easy for you to have done another film in exactly, you know, because there's nothing wrong with everything that's been released, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But it would have been easy to carry on in that vein, Seth. It you know, with the greatest respect, it's probably far easier than what you've tried to do with Momo would have been to have done it in the same style.
Oh, yeah. It would be easier if we had made Boggy Creek Monster and then made every movie after Boggy Creek Monster in the same exact style that we made Boggy Creek Monster. But that would also get really boring for us. So even though – I mean, I don't consider Momo the first time that we've changed gears. I think every movie and miniseries in its own way sort of does this in its own unique way. And we – for me, it's always been about what is in service of the story. So rather than trying to force my own artistic voice or whatever, you know, my directorial vision onto the project, I always try to do what's best for what we've sort of dreamed up. And I think that works for us, but it also keeps things fresh. So it doesn't feel like we're just sort of regurgitating the same style over and over again. I mean, I think Terror in the Skies comes close to feeling like the Mothman of Point Pleasant, but it does its own thing. It opens with a very prolonged, you know, 3.5 minute narrative sequence that is very introspective, and it's a slower paced movie. I mean, we honestly, I don't think there's any two STM movies that are exactly alike in terms of the storytelling style. We've always tried to change things up, but it definitely. We definitely took it to a new level with Momo. I mean, it feels different from everything that's come before, but it also feels very much a part of everything that's come before, because I do think the documentary section feels like quintessential small town monsters to me.
Yeah. It's different, but it's from the same stable. I think like that, because like you refer to, I mean, you know, I'm not saying all the previous work is exactly, because they're not, because they flow
right.
differently, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
On the Search for Champ is not, even though it's a serial series, is not similar in the way in the search, you know, the Search for Bigfoot is, because they're filmed completely differently. The narratives are different. Obviously, Bigfoot centers more about, as we refer to, you're the fulcrum of that particular piece, whereas Champ's obviously you've kind of taken a back seat, and obviously Alexander was driving that particular. Ship, and obviously Alexander, I spotted him in the posse. Sure, that's Petticoat.
Yeah, no, he Alex was like vital to that, not just like being a part of like appearing in that scene, but he was vital to the lighting and fog machines and all sorts of stuff that night. So, yeah, there are things happening. There were things happening that night that we would not have been able to get the movie made without Alexander. And Alex is actually going to be here tomorrow morning. I'm picking him up from the airport around 11.
Yeah, well, send him my very best.
I will.
I'm looking forward to, because he's got his Big Cats films coming soon, so I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Right, well, I think we can part Momo. I think we've covered it, but congratulations on it, Seth. It's a cracking film. I loved it to bits, and I know for a fact I'm going to certainly add to my two viewings so far, because the second viewing made me laugh.
And
it was like you said, you know, I spotted different things and little in jokes and stuff. It was great.
There's a lot.
Yeah. So next I'm not sure, you might still be continuing it, but In the Search of UFOs, how's that gone?
We've only gotten one trip out of the way so far. So we actually have some big shoots coming up. So we have, We have a 10-day shoot in October that starts in Orlando because we're going on a family vacation to Orlando, and then we're picking up – and then Shannon's flying to Orlando and meeting us while we're still on our family vacation. And then we're getting 10 days of filming out of the way. That will sort of encompass the southern states, and then we'll go to many different locations on the East Coast. And then there's another trip coming up in November that will take us to Los Angeles for 2.5 days. So that trip, the Los Angeles leg of that trip should close us out for filming. So I'd say as of now we have 1/3 of our filming out of the way. But it's going really well. I mean, we've had some really we've had some really fun experiences and got some great interviews. I mean, I'm already trying to sort of catalog footage and get things in order, and even start some editing. And yeah, we've got some really, it is completely different from any other small town monsters because it's much more based in urban areas. I mean, the opening of episode one is beginning in Las Vegas. So, I mean, the bright lights and massive crowds of people and all that kind of thing. So it's going to feel a little different from On the Trail of Bigfoot for sure. But, yeah, we're going to hit Area 51, and we hit Phoenix and Sedona and desert and forest and city and all kinds of things. It'll feel like a real concise sort of travelogue and hopefully a very unique look at the UFO phenomenon told in vignettes. I mean, you can call them episodes if you want, but they're almost like little vignettes, little peeks into different aspects of the subject.
Yeah, because I know obviously you've, as you touched on there, you've done Nevada, because I know you went to speak and meet with Dr. Lynn Katai, I believe.
Yeah, actually the first interview was Lynn. We shot 8 interviews, or it might have been 9 interviews, in basically what amounted to like 4 days of filming. Traveled 20 hours, and shot over 1,000 individual B-roll shots. So, and Lynn was great. Yeah, we interviewed her right in Phoenix. She was the first one we spoke with, and she was fantastic.
Excellent. And I think you skirted Area 51 as well.
Yeah, we actually interviewed a former MP right at the gates of Area 51, which was cool because that was total coincidence. He just happened to be there and was willing to talk to us. So we interviewed him sort of about, you know, what the logistics of Area 51 security are actually like. So we didn't really get into UFOs and aliens with him. We were getting the nitty-gritty, you know, security info from the guy, and that was really cool.
Yeah, because I noticed the first two idiots have been arrested today, haven't they? Trying to,
who were broken. Oh, really? I didn't even see.
Yeah, there's two YouTubers from Holland have been picked up flying drones and have been arrested and are currently detained.
Awesome. Can't wait yeah. Through watch the rest of them go down.
Ironic, I think both of them have run separate channels. One has a ghost hunting channel, which you think, well, fair enough, Area 51, but apparently the other guy runs a DIY channel and he's just turned up, and I was like, right, okay, so I don't know what this has got to do with do it yourself, but fair enough. So when do you think it's going to be out and released, Seth?
So I guess what the current plan is that On the Trail of UFOs will actually be the first release of 2020. So we're looking at March again, just like we did with On the Trail of Bigfoot. Yeah. And then that would be followed in September by The Mothman Legacy, which would actually premiere at the Mothman Festival. And then that will be followed in December by the Mark of the Bell Witch. So that's sort of our 2020 in a nutshell, with the Kickstarter launching Thursday, February 6th.
For all three?
Yeah. It'll fund all three.
Brilliant. Because I know when we spoke last time, there was a little bit of reticence because obviously the Bell Witch is going to be the first historic case you guys are going to tackle. So have you even considered your options or your plan, Seth, or is it a case of let's get in search of Out of the Way first?
No, I'm, as of right now, I'm doing sort of, I'm doing work on all three. Mm. So I'm looking into the Mothman stuff. I'm looking into the Bell Witch stuff. But my focus, my full focus is on the trail of UFOs. And then I'd say maybe like 30% of my focus is on Mothman. And then there's maybe like 5%, 10% on the Bell Witch right now. Right now, the biggest thing with the Bell Witch is just sort of figuring out what the narrative device, what the storytelling device is that we're going to go with, and how the style of the movie is going to be.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible case. You know, I mean, what we're talking, what, 175 years ago?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not, so it's, it, even in a historical situation, it's a hell of a trip back as well, because it's, you know, I know most famous poltergeist cases are a good two or three decades ago, Seth, but this is a real cultural shift as well as a historical one.
Oh, yeah, and still is. Mm. Yeah, where I don't think it's going to strictly be historical, by the way. We've got some interesting leads that would take us in other directions now. And it's exciting. Like, we're excited to get into making it just because visually we know what we're going to do in terms of sort of the look of the recreations, and we're going with like a black and white,
sort of a very modern horror vibe is what we're going for. This thing just changed my speakers again without me doing anything.
Yeah. You kind of flipped in and flipped out there, but we'll hopefully not have annoyed the Bell Witch to have caused some electrical interference.
Yeah, she's after me.
Oh. I mean, it's a case I've always been, because I've mentioned before, I absolutely love poltergeist stories. Mm-hmm. And this one particularly, because it's I was actually speaking to a Scottish author yesterday, Jeff Holder from the UK, who's a massive knowledge base on poltergeist cases, and with the Bell Witch came up, because it's probably the only case where there's a recorded fatality through the actual haunting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that alone makes it a very unnerving, you know, story in itself. But there's also the idea that so many people don't even know how much of that original story is true, how much of it's been falsified over the years. So we're going to delve into all that too.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that is that there should be some really good historical records, both in the sort of religious aspect, because they were often the main keepers of the locality's information at that time. You know, everything kind of went through your local religious leaders, as they kind of kept a record of the area's comings and goings, as it were, not just birth, deaths and marriages, but other aspects as well.
Right. Yep. Yeah, there's a lot to it.
Yeah. So all in all then, is that where you've kind of penciled in, and there's nothing else on the horizon, or is it a case of, right, these are our three primary projects, and to hell with 2021?
No, 2021 is going to be we know what we're doing as far as On the Trail of goes. As far as the films go, it's still kind of up in the air. So we'll see. And some of this is going to play out based on what happens in the next few months and into 2020. But this is the first time where we don't have an exact roadmap for what our subjects are for the films years out either. So we are locked through 2021 as far as On the Trail of goes. And then we have tentative titles for 2021 and even 2022, but it can go anywhere. I can tell you that the name of the next trilogy following Southern Monsters is going to be Desert Dwellers.
Oh, intriguing. Yeah. Well,
Mongolian death worms. We're solely three movies about the Mongolian death worm.
Strangely enough, I have a book about that very subject next to me. Written by one of our eminent cryptozoologists over here, a gentleman called Dr. Carl Schuker.
I've messaged back and forth with Carl, actually.
Oh, he's an absolute gent. He's a real legend over here. He's a superstar. He's so knowledgeable. He's a phenomenal resource for cryptozoology in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, with that, Seth, I just want to congratulate you again on a fantastic film. It's really worth, as we've both said, a repeated viewing. It's one of those films that makes you laugh. The first time I saw it, I was beginning to question if I actually read Lyle's book, because I was thinking, I'm sure I don't remember this happening. But then obviously it all makes sense when you come to it again. I was beginning to question my own sanity. So when's the film's out? September the 20th. Is that on the usual platforms?
Yeah, Amazon, Vimeo On Demand, VidiSpace, and DVD.
Lovely. And in regards to the back catalogue and keeping up to date, where can everybody find you and follow you and take notice of what's going down in the world of Small Town Monsters, Seth?
Smalltownmonsters.com and onthetrailof.tv.
Oh, fantastic. Well, listen, thank you once again for your time. Congratulations on appearing for the third time. You've completed the hat trick, and I'll probably leave you alone for this year.
I wish we could have drug Adam in, but he'll be back once he buys a new car.
Well, like I say, send him my very best. I know I was looking forward to him. I do keep in touch with Adam. He's a top fella.
Yeah.
So send him my very warmest regards, and hopefully one day we will speak again.
Yep.
But listen, thank you as always for your time and your trouble. It's always a pleasure, and the very best of success with Momo.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. Take care.
You too.